Hello, and welcome to Endeavors. Indecision keeps me up now. Need another place to mind my mind. Give a little bit of God to sin. Keeping safe is keeping you away. Which chronicles the Humboldt Broncos hockey team the season after their tragic bus crash. It premieres on CBC POV on August the 15th. He is Kevin Eastwood, and I spoke with him last week. Kevin Eastwood, hello. Welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you have a new documentary out on CBC Hot Docs, Humboldt, the next season. I can't imagine this was an easy project to make.
No, that's correct. I mean, I have experience with filming, I guess, sensitive subject matter in the past from other documentary projects I've done. I did a film about paramedics and PTSD. Last year, and before that, I spent a couple of years in an actual emergency room, an operating emergency room for a documentary series. So I've been around tragedy and things like that, but obviously that's always very different, and there's a great kind of emotional sensitivity when dealing with people who have lost so much as the subjects in this project have. So I'm certainly very grateful to the families and the survivors who shared their stories with us.
You know, given that you started filming in the August after the tragedy happened, were there cries of it's too soon?
I mean, yeah, that might have been what one would expect, but I would say there had already been so much media attention since when it happened back in April of that year. So by August, certainly there wasn't any, people were saying that probably the moment after it happened, and the town was besieged with international press. So it certainly wasn't a refrain that was still particularly loud when we were there, because by August, people had become somewhat, if not used to it, it had just been already going on for a while. So that said, we were very cognizant of the fact that people have already been kind of taxed with the burden of media kind of being very invasive, and often media can be, and look, I know I'm as a documentary filmmaker, I'm part of the media, so I'm not pretending that I'm excluded from this, but I know that a lot of practices of telling other people's stories can feel very, if not exploitive, and it can be that, but just even very extractive, like people are mining it like it's a commodity, and then putting it out there and not really worrying about the consequences of how they acquired that story. For us, it was a very different case because we were around for the ensuing year. So we knew that we had to behave and act respectfully to people. Otherwise, we would not be welcome when we showed up on our next visit. So I think that's what's different about documentary versus typical news journalism, is we're around for a longer haul. So we're trying to build relationships. And so we were trying to therefore act to people who were sharing their stories like we would to anybody else we wanted to have a long-term relationship with.
Given that the parents and the survivors of Humboldt had already had so much media focused on them, did that make it, what was it easier to get them to talk?
Yes and no. I mean, I think it was really up to every individual. Some people were very articulate and very forthcoming, and others didn't really want to share much, and we respected that. Anytime we approached anybody and tried to talk to them about things, if they were not interested, then we took that cue and we tried not to bother them again. And then there was others that, for whatever reason, were comfortable sharing their story. And I think some of the people perhaps they were just like, okay, this has happened, so I may as well accept that. I don't really know. I didn't ask them why they would be willing to share their story. But for some, it genuinely felt therapeutic. I know for others it's the opposite, but for some people, and people often think that's strange, but having dealt with people telling stories in often vulnerable places, whether they be somebody in the downtown east side of Vancouver, somebody in an emergency room, I recognize that sometimes sharing a story has a form of empowerment for the individual that's dealing with a crisis or dealing with challenges in their lives.
You mentioned how you were cognizant and aware of the situation. And whenever I talk to documentary filmmakers, it's always an interesting discussion about whether they include themselves in the project and become part of the movie, or whether they remove themselves from it and just, you know, or use narration, or in your case, you use nothing at all. How early on did you figure out the tone you wanted to set for this piece?
I mean, for me, I'm just always a fan of letting the subjects tell the stories themselves. I'm not very interested in asserting my own voice in any of the projects I've ever done. I think that it makes it more of a collaboration and less extractive if you let people describe what they've gone through themselves. And yes, obviously, there's still the selection of footage and editing that happens. But I think as long as you let people tell things generally in their story and are just focusing on the editing isn't changing what they're saying, just, you know, making it sometimes more clear and concise, then I think you're doing a service to those people. So I was certainly never interested in applying my own take or commentary on the event. I didn't think that's for me to offer. It's slightly different for my filmmaking partner, Lucas, the co-director, who was connected to the story because he knew Mark Cross, the assistant coach of the Humboldt Broncos. That was his best friend. And so he was very much, much closer to the story than me. That said, Lucas, too, didn't put himself in the film. You don't hear from him. We were more interested in letting the community share their story in their own words. And I think that's kind of what's different than how typical news media handled the story.
You know, just on the subject of media, this is not the first mass sports tragedy that we've heard of. There was the hockey plane crash in Russia a few years back. There was the Colombian soccer team, I think, a few years back. And yet Humboldt, and maybe it's because we're closer to it because we're Canadian, but it's the coverage of it seemed a lot more intense and a lot more scrutinized. Is that just what the nature of what media has become these days? It's a lot more of everything in your face?
Well, I think it's always been that way. I mean, there are always certain kind of stories that are going to get more coverage and replay, but I think, you know, for better or for worse, human beings are often interested in hearing about tragedies. I mean, you could look at that cynically and think we're just a bunch of rubbernecking people as if there's a car accident on the side of the highway. I'd like to think that there is something ultimately good that is reflected in that, and it's about people having care and concern and compassion for other people in their own country or in the world. So I think people respond mostly because it's really affected them personally, and they've had a reaction in their heart to the news story. And you can say what you will about like why this event. I think a lot of people feel connected to hockey in this country, and I think a lot of people will obviously always feel connected to when tragedies befall younger people. So I think those are the reasons, and I don't think it's just something sensationalistic. I think most people were genuinely powerfully impacted by the event. And when you go on social media or comment boards on any of the news reports, most people are just bearing their heart in the comments and were really deeply affected. So I think that shows that we actually have like more potential for interconnection with other people than otherwise. I think it's ultimately a good thing.
Hockey has always been a very much Canadian thing. But going into these small towns, Humboldt and a lot of the surrounding towns in Saskatchewan, what was the sense you got of how much hockey and the teams bring those communities together?
Well, that's what I really saw for the first time and was really blown away by was just seeing how in these small towns, not just Humboldt, but also like Nipawin or Estevan or Melford, like when we were going to other games, when they were having away games, when the Broncos were having away games, we would see these arenas in these small communities and the whole town would come out. And, you know, I live in Vancouver, so I think that, like, oh yeah, a hockey game is this big commercial thing because it's at Rogers Arena, and when the Canucks play, there's just, you know, it's a totally different thing. But when you see what it's like in a smaller community, everybody comes out, everybody knows everybody, and that really blew me away, and I thought that was incredible, and that made me have a greater appreciation for what the role of hockey is across the country, and, you know, especially in the winter months when it's generally cold and inhospitable outside. People are going inside to these warm arenas. Well, sometimes they're cold, but still, they're like, there's a sense of like warmth and community that's happening inside. And I got that now for the first time in my life.
Two other storylines that really interested me in the film were Logan Boulay and Evan Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize that after Logan's death, there was a spike in 100,000 more organ donations. And that angle of the story didn't seem to be covered as much in at least in the mainstream as perhaps the actual tragedy. I'm curious if you learned anything about organ donation while talking with Logan's parents.
I mean, I think his parents, Bernie and Toby Boulay, are just remarkable people. They've done so much in the aftermath to raise awareness about the importance of organ donation. And, you know, and obviously their son himself, Logan, did, you know, the greatest act that you can kind of do in death, which is to be an organ donor. And I think all of that, both what he did before he died by making himself registered and making it be known to his friend, and then them stepping up afterwards, I just think that's genuine, like, life-saving, heroic stuff. I've spent, like I said, time in emergency rooms, so I know what the gift of life of having an organ donor really means. And the statistics across Canada for organ donation are really disappointing, and it's kind of shocking that we still have this struggle. I mean, it's different how you register in each province, but some provinces it's as low as 11% of the people who are eligible. And, you know, people are on wait lists all the time and their time passes. So it's just, I think that is a really valuable message to share. And I think the entire Boulay family are just heroes. I certainly wouldn't fault anyone for in the aftermath of losing a loved one, whether it be a son, a spouse, or colleague, whatever, for just wanting to, like, go and hide in a dark cave for the rest of, you know, the year or their life and just grieve privately. But to go out and be sharing Logan's story, his parents have just done amazing work. And they've been doing talks all across the country and beyond. It's just, it's really amazing.
And I brought up Evan Thomas because I was really impressed and intrigued by the way his father sort of made sense of all this. First in meeting the driver of the semi-truck. When you first learned that he wanted to do that, how did you and your colleague approach that?
Well, I attended the sentencing hearings in Melford, and I saw that happen. There was a recess in kind of the proceedings, and, you know, generally media were sitting in one area and then the families and others were kind of sitting in other seats. And so I was sitting just kind of in the media seats that were not right near the front, about three rows back, but I was in the front row of that section. And I saw Scott Thomas sitting, or I saw him off on the side, but I saw the Sidhu family in front of me, and I saw Scott kind of pass by them, and I saw this interaction, and I was like, what is going on? That's really surprising. I didn't think that they would have had any interaction. And then I saw them all walk out of the room together, and then I saw Jasper himself, who had been sitting just at the front of the kind of the table, get up and fall in behind them. They all walked out of the room together, and I was like, what is happening in this moment? And nobody else had clocked it. And so I had been very curious to know what had gone on, and that's how, and Scott had shared his story elsewhere. But I do think that's a really remarkable moment for him to, and I think as he says in the film, it was really meaningful to get that kind of apology firsthand. I was there when Jasper Singh Sidhu made his apology at the very end of the sentencing, when the judge asked if he had anything to say, and rarely is that opportunity ever taken by people in court. And so to actually see somebody address the court and address the families that were present and express his remorse and his sadness was one of the most powerful and moving things I've ever seen in my life. And I'd say a lot of people there was the same.
When this tragedy first happened, I was actually surprised by the number of people who sympathized a little bit with Sidhu, just in terms of, you know, the long working hours and everything that comes with being a truck driver. Were there ever discussions about interviewing him or the Sidhu family for this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, whenever you're making a film, you try to cast a wide net and try to talk to as many people connected to the story as possible. That didn't happen for us. I don't know why, but we never did get to speak to him. We would have welcomed him to talk to us, but it didn't happen. So, but yeah, we pretty much tried to talk to anyone who was willing to talk to us, but respected anybody that didn't want to.
One other thing that I liked about Scott Thomas, and you actually end the film with it, is his sort of reflection on life. And he talks about how Evan was probably able to, because he was standing up, so he was able to take one breath, and then it was over. And how all our lives could be over in one breath. Has doing this project and speaking with somebody like Scott made you think about life differently at all?
I mean, I put that in the film because that's generally how I feel already. You know, I've seen lots and lots of people in an emergency room for something. I mean, the nature of an emergency department is unlike any other ward in a hospital. It's where you go for an emergency for something you didn't know you had to worry about 2 hours before. So I've seen everything from people stepping off a curb too quickly to having a wall at a construction site fall on them to being hit by a stray bullet. So, like, I know that life can turn on a dime, and if I wasn't already overwhelmingly aware of that from that experience, I was once dropped by a sudden cardiac arrest when I was in the middle of doing another project. So I once dropped dead myself. So I'm aware that the boulders out of the blue can come out of nowhere. And so I certainly feel that greater appreciation for life. Perhaps I'm probably somewhere on that gradient of having post-traumatic, if not a disorder, then a post-traumatic growth from my own experience. And that probably makes me feel an affinity and a connection to anybody else that has experienced that. And I think people feel that. First of all, they can feel it firsthand. I think some of the survivors certainly have that. And then I also think sometimes people, just in the way that people can have vicarious trauma, you can also have vicarious PT, post-traumatic growth. You can appreciate life that much more, even if your life wasn't threatened, but because you lost somebody. And so, you know, I wouldn't want anybody to go through that. But as somebody who has had that, it certainly makes me have a heightened appreciation for every moment of life. And I think we should all probably have that. And I think if we did, we'd conduct ourselves differently. So I think that's a worthwhile reminder to always share. And Scott Thomas articulated in a way that I just thought was really powerful and better than anything I could have said myself.
Is there a feeling of hope in Humboldt, considering how well they actually did this past season? Do they feel hopeful?
I don't know if I would say that. I would say that there's still a lot of grief and trauma, and I think they're going to be still in mourning for quite a while. I think a lot of people have demonstrated a remarkable strength in building their lives again, but I also get that some people don't feel that they need to do that, and that's also totally respectable. Sometimes when life is really, really awful, you are absolutely entitled to just being miserable and furious and angry at the universe for a while, and if not forever. So I get both reactions completely, and I think there are probably a whole range in that town and beyond. So I don't know if I would say that there's a dominant theme of hope amongst anyone. I think there's people all at different levels of healing.
So on that note, as we wrap up, what do you want the audience to take away from this film?
Well, I think as Scott Thomas kind of sums up at the end, you know, life can turn on a dime, and whether it's not something as obviously acutely awful as a bus crash where 16 people die, we all experience loss in our lives. We all experience the loss of loved ones, and I think if we know that can happen always, then hopefully we will value just the regular days, the normal days where it seems like everything is just status quo, that much more, because even that is really quite special. There's nobody that lost somebody in the Humboldt bus crash that wouldn't, you know, give everything in the world just to have one fleeting, idle moment with any of their loved ones once again. And a lot of us are experiencing those daily with the people that we do love, so we should just cherish those and value them.
That was Kevin Eastwood. He is the co-director of the documentary Humboldt, The Next Season, which premieres on CBC POV on Thursday, August 15th. Part of the reason this show didn't go up last night is I was editing it and putting it all together, and my two guests, Kevin Eastwood, who you heard from, and a band called Scream at Traffic. And as I was putting it together, something noteworthy in Canadian sports happened. That's the thing about sports. I may work at a nerd bar, but occasionally, yes, I do watch and follow some sports ball. Now, most people close to me know that I am a huge baseball fan and love the Blue Jays, my boys in blue. But I am also a closet tennis fan. For years I've loved Roger Federer and other people like Juan Carlos Ferrero back in his day and Guga. Patrick Rafter was my first favorite player. But the thing that happened in Canadian tennis yesterday was that Bianca Andreescu, the 19-year-old from Mississauga, won the Rogers Cup. She became the first Canadian woman in 50 years to win in Toronto. The first Canadian woman to win the modern Canadian Open. And she did it against none other than the greatest female tennis player of all time, perhaps the greatest player in history, man or woman, any gender, Serena Williams. Now, it's unfortunate that Serena had to retire only 20 minutes and 4 games into the set with back spasms. But coming on her home soil, a win is a win for Bianca. I first interviewed Bianca over the phone back in February, and I aired her interview on an episode in early March when the other guest was actor Henry Ian Cusick. At the time, she was fresh off her unbelievable maiden final at the season opener for the WTA Tour in Auckland, where she lost in 3 sets to an unbelievable matchup. Since then, she has won 2 major tournaments, the aforementioned Rogers Cup here in Toronto and the BNP Paribas Open at Indian Wells, in addition to a 125K tournament, which is a smaller tier tournament, in Newport Beach. She started the year, I believe, ranked 100 and something. I can't even remember anymore. And with this win yesterday, she is now ranked number 14 in the entire world. In honor of BB's victory, I am re-airing her interview. Here is my conversation with Canadian tennis champ Bianca Andreescu. Bianca Andreescu, thanks so much for being here today. Welcome.
Hey, thank you. It's my pleasure.
So, first of all, congratulations. Has the success of the past month sunk in for you at all yet?
I think it slowly is. I'm still in shock, I guess. Or not in shock, but just numb about the whole thing. I really can't complain with what I've achieved so far. So hopefully I can keep it up the rest of the season.
During your run in Auckland, after you beat Caroline and then Venus, when did you realize that something special was happening for you?
Caroline. I remember before the match, I just told myself that I just want to put up with her, you know, be able to rally with her. And after I won the first set, that's when I realized that I could actually beat her. So after that, I was like, okay, let's keep it going. And then I beat Venus, and then I got to the finals, and then I really couldn't believe it.
Venus is a titan in tennis, and I know I saw an interview where you said for 10 minutes you were telling your team to pinch you. Just the aspect of competing against somebody like Venus. What goes through your head mentally when you found out that you were drawn up against her in the quarterfinals?
I try not to focus on who's on the other side when I'm playing, but against her, obviously, that was really hard to do. Once I get into the match, after a couple games, I just try to focus on myself. And I think that's what I did well that match. I just focused on playing the ball and not worrying who's on the other side. Play the right tactics, and I really just believed in myself.
You know, given that you went straight from the final against Yulia to qualifying for the Aussie Open almost straight away, how do you give yourself both a mental and physical break and physical breaks in such a short turnaround?
Well, that's what I signed up for. Tennis is a sport where you can play every day of the week if you want to. I definitely don't recommend that, but that's the sport. After a long tournament like that, though, I try to take 2 or 3 days off before the next one, just not picking up a tennis racket, not doing anything, just maybe visiting the city, and that really helps for me to just refocus and re-energize.
The Aussie Open was your second Grand Slam tournament, but what went through your head when you realized that you had actually qualified for the first major of the year?
Just pure joy, really. It's hard to describe the feeling. All I can say is that it's a dream come true. I've always wanted to play on these big stages against the best players, and I'm already doing that, so I'm really, really grateful.
And then you, not only that, but you won your first match, your first Grand Slam tournament match. What did you feel after you successfully won your first round matchup in Melbourne?
Yeah, like I said, it's a dream come true. It's my first WTA title, and definitely a very memorable one. I guess all of the work that I'm putting in and that I've put in throughout the years is paying off. So I'm just really, really happy. I've been through a lot with injuries, and all I can say is that it's worth it in the end.
You mentioned injuries, and I know in the matchup against Yulia, your back flared up a little bit. How is the back doing, and do you have any, you know, special things that you do to make sure that you stay physically healthy throughout a tournament?
I try to get as much sleep as I can. I try to eat the best as I can and get treatment as much as possible. And I think that's key for any athlete. So I want to keep doing that for the rest of my career. And I think if I do that, then I can do really great things in the sport.
After you played in Australia, and then you won in Newport Beach. Well, first of all, the moment where you finally got to hoist the trophy in Newport, how you talked about, you know, meeting your goals, but just the act of, you know, being victorious and hoisting the trophy up in Newport, what mentally, emotionally, what did that do for you?
It definitely gives me confidence, and I believe that confidence is really big. It's a really big aspect of anything, and that's how I'm feeling right now. But I have a really good team around me that's keeping me grounded, so that's definitely helping, and hopefully I can keep this confidence for the rest of the season.
You've already met your first goal of the season, which was to gain direct entry to Roland Garros in the French Open. And I know you've all stated you want to make the top 50 this year. Are there any other objectives that you want to meet come the end of the season in November, December?
Yeah, I haven't actually sat down with my coach yet to reevaluate them, but I will next week when I see him. But on my note, I'd for sure like to crack the top 50, maybe even the top 40 by the end of the year.
Speaking of rankings, how does it feel to be Canada's new number one on the WTA?
Pretty damn good. I put in a lot of work, and it's really paying off. And with the support of my team, with the support of Canadians, the Romanians, you name it, I'm really, really happy.
You know, between yourself and Jeannie and Gabriella, Francois, and then Milos, Dennis, and Vasek, it seems like Canadian tennis has never been better than it is right now. Do you have any insight as to perhaps why we are succeeding at the sport at a level that we haven't previously?
Yeah, I think Tennis Canada is doing a very good job with everything, really. They have incredible coaches. They have an incredible facility in Toronto and Montreal, and I think in Calgary as well. We don't have a lot of players, which I think helps because the trainers and the coaches can focus on all the players individually. And all the support that they give us, win or lose, they treat us the same, which really makes a difference. So I'm really grateful for all that they've done for me and just for Canadian tennis in general.
When you came back home for the first time after the Australian Open and then Newport Beach, and you stepped into Pearson and saw your parents and your friends. What was that like for you? You're back on home soil, and now everyone knows your name.
It was definitely pretty overwhelming at first, but I have a great team around me that's keeping me grounded. My friends and family as well. All their support means so much to me. So stepping back on home soil was definitely a highlight. And I got a chance to just spend some time with my family before going to Fed Cup, which is really nice.
And congratulations on the Fed Cup, by the way. You guys advanced, I think, to the second round for the first time since 2015. But the team that they put together for the Fed Cup, what do you attribute your guys' success to? How do you think your skill sets play off each other?
I think the teamwork was number one for us. That week and every week, it's the only chance you get in this individual sport to play as a team. So I think we did that pretty well. And also we have an incredible team of doctors and physios and coaches as well that came with us to the Netherlands, which definitely helped as well.
I know growing up on the junior circuit, you idolized Simona Halep, and she was actually the one that convinced you to turn pro a couple years ago. What is your relationship like with her and some of the other, I guess, more seasoned players on the tour? Do you get to get advice from them at all from time to time?
Doesn't really happen on tour. We're in our own world. It's a competitive sport, so you don't really get much of that. But everyone's friendly. It's not like we're enemies or whatever, whatever you like to call it. But no, you don't get any of that.
You mentioned that you have a really good team that keeps you grounded, and I'm just curious about the I guess the relationship and the process. That you go through with your coach Sylvain every time you come back to Canada. Do you come back and work with him on specific mechanical things like tweaks to your game, or is it a more sort of overall big picture type of deal?
It really depends how I feel. For example, if after a tournament. And after a couple of days off, my forehand feels off. We'll work on technical things. But it's usually more overall, like building the game, working on executing different tactics, also working on the mental aspect of the game as well as the physical too.
How much does the mental aspect of the game get underrated? How hard is it to stay focused out there for, you know, an hour, 2 hours?
Yeah, it's definitely underrated. I think the mental aspect of anything really is number one over anything. So that's why I'm trying my best to work on that, sometimes with a psychologist, but mainly with myself. I'm a pretty spiritual person, so I meditate a lot. I do a lot of yoga, and I think that really helps my focus on the court and being able to reset, refocus, and stay in the present moment.
Just as we wrap up here.
One more question.
Perfect. Just as we wrap up here. What is the next big moment that you're looking forward to in tennis? And is there one opponent that you haven't faced yet that you would really like to face?
Well, my goal in the sport is to become the best player and person that I can be, to win as many Grand Slams as I can and to become number one in the world, and to also do a lot for the sport and be an inspiration to others. And a player that I would like to play would definitely have to be my idol, Simona Halep, and Serena Williams, hopefully, before she retires. At least I got one Williams sister in.
Yeah, there you go, right? Bianca Andreescu, thanks so much for your time today, and continued success all this year. Canada's rooting for you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it all.
That was my conversation with Canadian tennis champion Bianca Andreescu. That interview first aired on the March 10th episode. That does it for me today. Because of the slight rated of today's show, there will be two other shows this week. My next show on Thursday will feature filmmaker Wendy McComb and band Screaming at Traffic. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now. Well, just say it like it's a real thing. Just say it like it's a real thing. I just like to have a lot of sex.